Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
Guitar mic. From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 40 years ago this weekend, 500,000 people descended on Max Jesker's quiet New York farm for the Woodstock Music Festival. Richie Havens looked out and sang.
Freedom, freedom. Freedom, freedom, freedom.
It was three famous days of mud and music, a signature event for rock and roll and a whole generation. 40 years on, several generations can look back now. What did it mean? This hour on Point, why we're still talking about Woodstock. You can join the conversation. Were you there? Were your parents, your grandparents' generation? What did we glimpse at Woodstock? Can we find it at Burning Man, at Bonnaroo? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Couldn't do that in 1969. Joining me now from New York City is Anthony DeCurtis. He's a critic and contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine, author of Rocking My Life Away. Anthony DeCurtis, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
My pleasure, Tom.
So here we are, 40 years, and the New York Times is saying, you know, why are we still talking about this moldy nostalgia of Woodstock? And yet it doesn't go away. How much is the weight of the event itself, its resonance? How much is endless marketing? How do you look at it, Anthony?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult to pry those things apart. And, you know, to be honest, it was difficult to pry those things apart pretty soon after Woodstock. You know, there was... there was a sense of the event's importance, even as it was happening. I mean, I was in New York City. I didn't go up, upstate to the show.
You were in New York and didn't go because?
Well, I didn't go because, you know, I mean, I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
I had seen almost all of those bands. And, you know, I mean, I lived in Greenwich Village. I lived on Bleecker Street.
So you were right in the heart of it there.
Yeah,
you didn't need to go to the farm, maybe.
Yeah, you know, the Fillmore East and all of the clubs were a walk away. So I'd seen Jimi Hendrix. I'd seen Janis Joplin. You know, I'd seen the incredible string band and Tim Hardin and Richie Havens. And,
yeah.
You know, to me, it wasn't necessarily, you know, and it just seemed like, you know, a lot of bands, you know, that I knew about already and had seen were going to be performing. But, you know, nobody knew what it was going to turn into. There was no sense that this was going to become what it became. But
do you remember how the news trickled? Yeah. Do you remember how the news trickled back, Anthony?
Oh, absolutely.
That something. What,
yeah,
how did that come in? Something's going on up there.
Yeah, there was this sense. You know, all that stuff that you know that's in the movie and that people talk about. You know, especially here in New York, in the sense, you know, the throughways closed. You know, everything's okay, and you know the reports began to trickle back that. Yeah, that people are having a great time. And that weekend, I actually went to see the incredible string band and Tim Hardin, both of whom had performed at Woodstock. And they were there, and, you know, the incredible string band were saying, you know, they had mud on their pants, and they were saying, you know, this is Woodstock mud, you know, as if they had
holy.
Got to Lourdes or something and brought it back to us, the faithful.
The documentary Woodstock made it famous. Of course, the concert lost all kinds of money, but it came back. Hand over fist over the years. Here's a little bit of tape from that documentary. Max Jesker himself taking the stage, the dairy farmer, couldn't be in Woodstock, moved to Bethel to his farm, those rolling hills that turned to mud. Here he is getting up on stage to address, who knows, 500,000 people on his farm on the final day of the festival.
I'm a farmer. I don't know. I don't know how to speak to 20 people at one time, let alone a crowd like this. But I think you people have proven something to the world. Not only to town of Bethel or Sullivan County or New York State, you've proven something to the world. This is the largest group of people ever assembled in one place.
Well, maybe not, but it was a lot of people. They heard a lot of music. Here's Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young at Woodstock, Wooden Ships.
Wooden ships on the water, very free. Easy, you know the way it's supposed to be. Silver on the shoreline, let us be. Talking about very free and easy.
Anthony Curtis is with us from New York, where he was as Woodstock went on. Didn't bother to go up. He'd heard all the music. Ann Powers joins us from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. She was still in short pants, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years old that summer. She's chief pop music critic for the Los Angeles Times, former editor for the Village Voice, author of Weird Like Us and Rock, she wrote. Ann Powers, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We're trying not to just have a boomer nostalgia fest here. I was too young. You were too young. But you grew up with the kind of, resonance of this at your back. When you look back on Woodstock and what it meant and how it sounded, I don't know, what did it mean to you as the next generation, maybe Gen X?
Well, I think I'm sort of on the cusp of the baby boom and Gen X being 45 years old, but yep. I definitely identified with the Gen X attitude about Woodstock and the counterculture in general when I was growing up, and definitely when I was a young rock and roll fanatic, which was, that was our giant shadow over us. And I think the Gen X cohort really wanted to make its own mark and always felt like it never got its own Woodstock, you know? So there was definitely a rebellion against both the idea of Woodstock, the idea of the counterculture, and the actual historical event. It was, you know, a bunch of dirty hippies eating brown acid, right? not the same, you know, importance or
you're saying magic. That was the Gen X view of Woodstock?
Yes.
Dirty
yes.
hippies eating that brown acid that they announced on the stage? It's not good.
So.
Don't touch it.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a time, you know, at the time, I think punk rock happened and indie rock, and Gen X was much more subcultural than counterculture. It was about your small community in your own locale, you know, and it wasn't about a huge mass gathering. We didn't really believe in that so much. Now, however, I think the younger generation is coming around to the countercultural style and some of the countercultural ideas again. So it's a great moment for Woodstock to turn 40 because the kids are into it.
We talked with the musician who played first that day, famously Richie Havens, a couple of years ago, asking him about the opening there, singer-songwriter, and Richie told us that he, you know, they'd pulled him out there, they were begging him to go back out and back out because they didn't have the other musicians in there. He described how that went, and his final encore there ended up becoming his well-known song, Freedom. Let's listen to how Richie Havens described the beginning and what he saw when he looked out from that big stage.
Well, I went back 6 times.
And
times.
It was 2 hours and
it was 2 hours and
minutes.
45 minutes later. I walk off for the 6th time, and they say, Richie, one more. So I go back to the stage, and I sit down, and I'm playing. If you watch the movie, I'm still playing the last song that I walked off with. Yeah. I sit down, and I start tuning my guitar, and I'm going, I don't know one more song I could sing. And so that long intro is me stalling yeah. to figure out what I was going to do.
And then it
but
came.
What came to me was I was looking at the freedom that my entire generation had been looking for since the 50s.
Richie Havens there on his big, long, endless opening act at Woodstock. Anthony Curtis, if that's what he was looking out on, it's hard to discount that, if indeed that's what it was.
Well, I think it partly was. You know, it's hard. I mean, I certainly understand, you know, what Ann was saying. And there was a sense, I mean, you kind of wish that what Woodstock seemed to represent maybe had a longer impact. I mean, it very quickly turned into a kind of marketing event. You know, that maybe, in fact, its longest lasting and most significant impact. But at that moment, it really did seem like something was possible. You know, there was a kind of sense of, hey, you know, there's a lot of us. You know, things were, you know, pretty splintered back then. It was very difficult, you know, to communicate. And there was this kind of sense of us and them, you know. And Woodstock was that moment where you realize, well, gee, there are maybe more of us than I had anticipated. And maybe, you know, some of this revolution stuff and things that people are talking about, maybe that's not so impossible.
Natalie's calling. She was there. Natalie, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What did you see? What was it like?
It was fabulous. I was hearing somebody talk about the mud a little while ago, and all I can do is tell you it was the most incredible feeling is walking through the pond where the cows, you know, drank from.
Yeah.
And because so many people were there, it squished up between your toes. It was mixed with, you know, other things from cows.
Sure.
So it was quite an aroma. But the thing that struck me the most about being there was the absolute wonderful kindness of strangers. I was telling the person that, you know, screens the calls, I had gone there alone, basically. I'd hitchhiked. And I bought tickets, silly me. And trust me, I discarded them a long time ago. But I was supposed to meet friends there, and we did not expect the crowds. And so we couldn't find each other. There were
nobody
no cell
did.
Phones.
Yeah.
There were no flags, no balloons. So I basically was on my own. And one of the first days, I got bad food and became ill. But the kindness of strangers, you know, couples would mother me. They would take care of me and find me a place to sleep at night underneath the trailers, those big, you know, the eight-wheeler thingies. And we would sleep under or in them. And, you know, it was a good time despite, you know, that.
Was it important? Was it important, Natalie? Did it really matter, or was it mud and a good time?
I hate to correct, but my name is actually Madeline.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. It was very important. It was an important time to strike out. And I don't mean hit, but it was an important time to stand up and say, this is what life is about. And life is about being. And at that point, it was about being surrounded with music and other people that loved music, and peacefully so, I might add. It was a wonderful event.
Madeline, it's great to hear from you. Thank you so much for calling. Anthony Curtis, Ann Powers, please stand by here. Santana at Woodstock. Your calls are welcome. Your experience is welcome. Your memory, or if you weren't alive, how do you look at it now? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Woodstock, 40 years ago this weekend. This, of course, Jimi Hendrix with his famous rendition, wrapping up the show with the star-spangled banner as only Jimi Hendrix could deliver it. Anthony DeCurtis is with us from Rolling Stone, and Powers with the Los Angeles Times. You can join us. Why are we still talking about Woodstock? What's made it last? The music, the moment, the marketing, something bigger? We're at 800-423-8255. Anthony DeCurtis, listening back to a lot of it just in the last couple of days, this is what stood out to me. This was some performance by Jimi Hendrix. But what did it mean, this version of the Star-Spangled Banner?
Well, it was kind of, you know, it was like the national anthem of Woodstock Nation. Yeah, that's what it, you know, that was a phrase that Abbie Hoffman, who, oddly enough, got kicked off the stage at Woodstock when he tried to get up and make a political announcement during the Who set. But, you know, there was a sense like we are redefining what America is. And Hendrix just kind of set the tone for that. You know, that, you know, on Monday morning, you know, it just was, you know, an astonishing thing. And just musically, you know, truly, truly brilliant.
When I look out across the footage of who was there, I mean, I'm struck now by, I mean, it looks very white. It looks kind of quite affluent when you look at the cars parked here and there. I mean, it doesn't exactly look like, you know, the whole nation rising up. Was it just a slice, Anthony? Was it like, I don't know, kids from the Upper East, Upper West Side who headed up? Or
Well, you know, I mean, class was certainly an issue that wasn't much on the table in, you know, back then with the counterculture. I mean, you know, certainly that was one. I mean, I was a city kid, you know, mm-hmm. a working class kid.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I didn't have a tent. You know what? I'm sure I had never stayed in a hotel by that point. So the idea of me even getting upstate, I certainly didn't have a car. So, yeah, it was, you know, those kind of things, I mean, and probably to this day are self-selecting. You know, who could afford to go? You know, you need in those days, I mean, whatever a ticket cost, I think it was like $20 or something.
Right, but, equivalent of,
you know,
$75
need,
today, I read. 18
you know,
in advance, 24 to
get.
Money.
You know, you need transportation. You know, you need to be able to pay for a place to stay, and that, you know, that eliminates a lot of people.
And when you hear, of course, Jimi Hendrix, it turns the Star-Spangled Banner into an anthem, also into a kind of protest song, the sound of bombs dropping. It was deep in the Vietnam War. And then you came along, sort of, as you say, you know, a half generation or generation later, Gen X. Mm. What about that piece of the political puzzle? I mean, was this when Abbie Hoffman got beamed on the head for trying to be political? Was this when culture actually booted politics off stage?
Well, that was a big tension in the countercultural era of the late 60s, early 70s. I mean, there were certainly amazing political movements happening at that time. Black Power, Students for a Democratic Society. I mean, politics was a major, if not the major, part of the counterculture. But there is kind of a view that culture took over, if you can make a distinction. I think that's a false distinction. Definitely in what some people call like the decadent end of the 60s era, people went back to the land. They were more interested in exploring their sexuality and exploring their identities. You had political movements that were identity-based, like feminism, that came along and kind of took the focus off old-fashioned politics. I did want to add that as far as class goes, punk rock was very working-class focused and celebrated the working class. So that was a piece that also came in the 70s, partly in reaction to the kind of middle-class idealism and perhaps delusion of some of the quote-unquote hippie movements.
Here's an interview from the time. This is the documentary Made There, came out in 1970, Woodstock. Michael Wadley's interviewing a young man at Woodstock who's not so sure why everybody's flocking to the festival at the time.
Why would 300,000, 120,000, 60,000, 70,000 people come to anything, you know, like just because it's music, you know? I mean, was music all that important? I don't really think so, but people don't know, you know, they don't know how to live, and they don't know what to do, and they think that if they can come here, they can find out, you know, what it is or how to maintain with it. Or it's just like people are very lost, I think. People that are nowhere are coming here because there's people that they think are somewhere, so everybody is, like, really looking for, you know, for some kind of answer, you know, where there isn't one.
Maybe there wasn't one, but there was a lot of music. Here's Janis Joplin with Try at Woodstock.
Try. Just a little bit harder, so I can love, love, love you. I'll tell myself, oh, I'm gonna try just a little bit harder, so I can give you to nobody else.
Janis Joplin, she was rocking, the crowd was rocking. Dawn in Columbia, South Carolina. You're on the air, Dawn. Hi.
Hi, Tom. My mother was at Woodstock, and she was pregnant with me at the time.
So you were there, too, we might say. Okay.
Yes, I was very affected by the music, I would say, in the womb. But she had gone through all the, you know, the horrible things that people her age, 23, had seen, you know.
The war, the assassinations, the riots.
Exactly. And she was the typical hippie chick, you know, and I think what the fellow before just said about trying to find something, I think they were, my parents were trying to find an answer to stuff there was no answer to. And with music, that, I think that's why Woodstock was so important.
Did your mother stay a hippie, Dawn?
I think in her heart she did, yeah, but she eventually became a little bit more straight and narrow. But I've been very influenced by music, not even because of her, but because of her spirit, you know, and the politics and the life that she had to endure. And it all really affected me. And for her to have been there for some reason really affected me. Because she was right in the middle of all the activism.
Now I'm looking at a note here saying that your mother, who was there with you in utero, your mother's a staunch Republican, and you?
I am in the middle. I voted for Obama. I also voted for Bush, so.
Whether you were the fetus or carrying the baby, you can go either way. Dawn, thanks very much for calling. Let's get one more right here from Mansfield, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the air. What do you know about Woodstock?
Hi, Tom. I was actually at Woodstock. I still have my tickets. They cost $15.
Okay.
We drove to Woodstock in a four-wheel drive Jeep. We got stopped by the police 10 miles from the festival field. However, there were more of us than there were of police. We kept on driving, and the best way to describe it, it looked like the evacuation at Dunkirk. Finally, we were able to find a campground, but there were so many people there, they were literally camping in the entrance to the campground. So we asked a homeowner if we could drive the Jeep across his lawn, up a hill, and there we would put the Jeep. We gunned the engine, the Jeep went up the hill, became airborne for a couple of feet, came down with a thud. We threw out an enormous, huge tarp that we would sleep under. That night it rained, removing all traces of the tracks of the Jeep, and people said, how did you get it in here? And we said, you didn't hear the plane. It was kicked out the back of a flying boxcar. His dad is in the Air Force Reserve.
Oh, boy.
And a story began to spread that these crazy freaks parachuted out a Jeep, and here they were. Attendance at Woodstock itself literally changed my life. When I saw how many people were there, I realized then I could do with my life as I wanted, and have not forgotten that experience.
That sticks with you. And parachute or no, Anthony DeCurtis, was that in the music? Was it in the moment? I mean, did you feel it even if you weren't there as something that liberated a bigger crowd than was there in the mud?
Well, I think that those things, I mean, are inextricable,
mm-hmm.
you know, the music and the moment. I mean, and that idea of searching that, you know, some people were talking about, you know, it was a pretty complicated time.
No kidding.
There was a lot going on. I mean, for example, on the Manson murders that occurred just the week before, there was a lot happening. And that idea that, you know, I think carving out a certain amount of time, in this environment, I think it really did mean something to people who were there, like that guy who was just talking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a sense in which, you know, I mean, we, I think, viewed musicians, rightly or wrongly, as kind of seers in a way, you know, and people who could teach us something. And so, you know, it was when somebody says, well, why are these people here for music? Well, that was why, you know, because there was a sense that, you know, that somehow these were kind of avatars, although that's a term that has a different meaning now, but that, you know, they were a little bit further along somehow were communicating something that might be of use to the rest of us.
You know, Anne, we heard Richie Havens talking, looking out and seeing that freedom. Martha Bayless has a nice essay at Wall Street Journal, it turns out, today, saying, you know, in that image at Woodstock of all that freedom, she said, it's hard to look out at those images now and not to think of later mass meetings in Krakow and East Berlin and Beijing and Kiev and very recently in Tehran, a kind of symbol of freedom that keeps on echoing. I don't know if Woodstock encompasses all of that, but it was, when you look back at the documentary, at the time people were amazed at how many of them there were, at how free they felt they could be. They seemed amazed themselves at what was happening.
Well, I think that's a great point. I mean, the previous caller that Anthony also mentioned, you know, the fact that he had never been in a crowd that big of like-minded, sort of like-styled people, Woodstock was one of the first. It wasn't the first festival. There were actually many music festivals that happened at that time, and they were all important. Monterey Pop was incredibly important. There were many regional festivals. But the thing is, you can't repeat that, you know? The first is the first, so later generations, those of us who came up in later eras, we couldn't have that Eden moment. There's a reason why Joni Mitchell wrote about getting back to the garden, you know? It really had that feeling of an origin myth. Now, we may also know that it is partly a myth, you know? Like the caller's myth that he created about the Jeep and parachuting in, you know? That
right.
didn't really happen. But we need our origin myths. And you know, I think by the time in the 70s and into the 80s especially, international movements were happening. For a lot of people my age, South African apartheid, the anti-apartheid movement was a huge political moment. And that's a world, you know, that was something that people all over the world responded to. So by that time you didn't feel like, wow, and for the first time I'm in a crowd. We were born in a crowd in a weird way. We were born with an international perspective, and that's all the more true now. So that if I hate the word innocence in a way, I don't know if I believe in it, but there seems to be a desire to hang on to innocence and feel that Woodstock was an innocent moment, that it opened people's eyes in a way that the rest of us who followed our eyes were open from childhood, you know? So I envy that a little bit.
It wasn't supposed to be in Bethel where it turned. It was supposed to be in Woodstock. Turned out 40, 50 miles away in Bethel. Martha Bayless writing today. It's interesting because Bethel, named after the biblical Bethel, first appears in Genesis, the place in Canaan where Jacob dreams of a stairway to heaven with messengers of God going up and coming down on it. Maybe musicians at that time. I'll ask you, Anthony, but here's Joe Cocker, help from my friends.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Yeah. Oh, baby, how you mind?
Joe Cocker at Woodstock. Anthony, you mentioned avatars before, and I couldn't help thinking, looking back at this, watching the faces of the musicians, a lot of them a little turbocharged, but the sort of self-understanding of musicians then and now, when you look back, did they think of themselves as avatars of something coming, something new, in a different way from what you see when you look out on the musical scene today, popular music today, Anthony?
Well, you know, I do think that they felt a connection to this larger community. And, you know, something like that Joe Cocker performance or, you know, that fabulous Richie Havens performance,
yeah.
You know, of Freedom, a song that essentially was improvising.
On the spot. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they found themselves in a situation, you know, Joe Cocker evoking the Beatles there, mm-hmm. you know, who were not at Woodstock, mm-hmm. but, you know, were obviously kind of, you know, important figures at that moment.
Sure.
And, you know, coming up with that song, rising to that occasion to, you know, kind of create this moment of communication, I think that they felt like they're you know, like that feeling that something's kind of coursing through, you know, the artist and the audience, you know, that they're sharing this. But the artist is the person on stage, and they're rising to the occasion. And, you know, there were a number of moments like that. You know, we talked about Hendrix, and mm-hmm. that certainly was another moment of that sort.
A lot of stuff coursing through at Woodstock. Sarah in Bridgehampton, New York. You're on the air, Sarah.
Hi there.
Hi.
My Woodstock experience was a whole lot different.
Okay.
I'd heard about it for weeks. Everybody I knew was excited about it. Some people got tickets and headed up there. They were on the road 16 hours and still couldn't get near the place and turned around in disappointment and came back down to Long Island where we live.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, while I was working in a little boutique in Job's Lane, Southampton, my husband-to-be, just a boyfriend then, and a friend of his, a surfer on the beach, sat down and plotted a different way to get there. And what they worked out was an airplane from East Hampton Airport to Sullivan County, and they talked a helicopter group from New York City to come up to Sullivan Airport to pick us up and to bring us into Woodstock. So we came in by helicopter.
Pretty high style.
And it was phenomenal. frankly, it wasn't much. It didn't cost much either.
Wow.
Nobody had thought to do it, that's all. And the helicopter guy basically agreed because he'd been hearing all the hoopla on the news, and he was curious. So in we came, circled it, this big bowl of people. But what fascinated me was for miles around, all the farm fields, or most of them, were filled with rows and rows of parked cars. And then when you flew over this natural amphitheater to see what we were told were 500,000 people, it certainly looked like it from the air, but I noticed all this yellow smoke coming up, and it didn't occur to me till we were almost landing what it was. It was marijuana smoke. And when they opened the helicopter, it whacked us in the face. Like an instant high.
No purple haze for you. It's something a little... Sarah, thank you very much for your call and your memory. Ann Powers, Anthony DeCurtis, please stand by. We're looking back at Woodstock, 40 years on. Here's Jefferson Airplane with Uncle Sam Blues. Join us, 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Uncle Sam ain't a woman. Can't take your man.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking back on Woodstock 40 years on with Anthony DeCurtis, critic and contributing editor at Rolling Stone, and Ann Powers, who joins us today from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, chief pop music critic for the Los Angeles Times, former editor for Village Voice. We are listening right there to Sly and the Family Stone with Higher. You can join the conversation. Boomers, what did this all mean? And 20, 30, 40-somethings, what does it mean to you? What do you hear in Woodstock's music? What do you see in the pictures, the footage? Do you wish you'd been there? Do you have your own in Burning Man and Bonnaroo? Do we glimpse another way at Woodstock, or was that just a good time? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Chris is calling from Vernon, Connecticut. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi. I know I don't have much time, so I just wanted to share. I could talk about Woodstock for months, but it was a pivotal moment in my life. I was going to UConn at the time.
Yeah.
And just to make it brief, we were into Karma a whole lot back then. And I got to within 17 miles of Woodstock on Friday afternoon, and then parked in on Route 17 in the one-way parking lot, inching our way through all of Friday night and the rain and everything until Saturday. By Saturday morning, no matter how close we got to the actual site of walking, we kept asking, and everyone said it was 8 miles further, like 8 miles high or something.
Right.
And we finally got to the site, and my girlfriend was complaining. She wanted to turn around and go home. I asked one of the guys in a car that there was one lane inching their way out of Woodstock. And they said, is it worth it going on? He said, it's worth it just to see a million freaks in one place. And that was all I needed. So we kept going. We got to the site. We're standing on top of the hill overlooking the stage in a sea of humanity, in a sea of hippie freak humanity. And I hear someone yelling my name, Malis, Malis. And I'm saying, I'm straight. I'm not doing anything yet. You know, I'm not hallucinating. And it turned out to be my best friend, George Jacoby, from UConn, who bumped into us in the sea of humanity.
Is that karma, Chris? Is that the proof of the pudding?
Yes, that is the proof. Similar to Sunday afternoon when Joe Cocker sang, and it started raining, and a million of us started saying, no rain, no rain, and the rain stopped. Now, we know scientifically it was a thunderstorm, traditionally short storm.
Right.
But just the fact that it stopped when we were chanting no rain just felt incredible. And those are the kinds of things that made Woodstock something above a rock festival. Rock festivals are great. I've enjoyed many of them, but there'll never be another Woodstock, and I'm just so thankful that I was there. I turned 60 this year. And so there are two milestones this year for me, that and the 40th anniversary of Woodstock.
You're right in the bullseye of the boomer generation, Chris. Thank you very much for that report. You know, of course, Joni Mitchell wasn't there. Her agent had her go on the Dick Cavett show instead. Others didn't show. The Doors didn't go. But she ultimately wrote Woodstock. You know, we're stardust. We're golden. How about it, Anthony? How much stuck you can hear in the callers who were there, the sort of the magic stick still has them reverberating a little bit. But
I would say so. I was imagining Anne listening to that, I must say. I mean, I know Anne, and she's a friend. It seemed very much like reliving Woodstock there. And, you know, look, I mean, I think that the experience, I think people did take those moments, you know, that sense of possibility. I mean, it's, as Anne pointed out about the Joni Mitchell song, what's intriguing about it is that it gets at, I think, all of that promise, and also there's a very, you know, there's a significantly darker aspect of it. Mm-hmm. You know, thinking about this period, I mean, just the other day I was thinking about the Rolling Stones, who were also not at Woodstock, but would be at Altamont a few months later.
Right.
You know, and that line, and Give Me Shelter, that's just become a kind of theme for all that. You know, just, you know,
Altamont, which was about death and hell's angels, not peace and love so much.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And like just those lines in that song, you know, war children is just a shot away, love sister is just a kiss away, that kind of both those things were true at that moment, you know, that all of the violence and all of the possibility for connection seemed to be, you know, kind of on everybody's skin.
You know, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young took Joni Mitchell's song and made it into this kind of rousing anthem. But I was reading not long ago, Camille Paglia wrote about it. And if I may, Anne, I want to just read what she said about Joni Mitchell's rendition, ultimately, of that song a year later, which was not a rousing anthem. She said, "This Woodstock is a harrowing lament for hopes dashed and energies tragically wasted. It's an elegy for an entire generation, flamingly altruistic, yet hedonistic and self-absorbed, bold yet naive, abundantly gifted yet plagued by self-destruction. These contradictions were on massive display at Woodstock, where the music was pitifully dependent on capitalist technology and where the noble experiment in pure democracy was sometimes indistinguishable from squalid regression to primal horde." Anne, over to you.
Well, that's heavy, but, you know, I can see that view of Joni's song. I mean, another story I've heard about why Joni didn't go to Woodstock was that she was dating, I think, Graham Nash at the time, and the boys in Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young didn't want her to go because they thought it would be too dangerous for her. So that kind of paternalistic attitude, which is hardly liberatory, right? So there's a contradiction. I think that's the kind of, those kinds of contradictions are what the next generation then critiqued. But what's interesting is now an even younger generation is starting to re-embrace the kind of countercultural aspect. So you have a group like Fleet Foxes, who actually sound almost very similar to Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. They have beards. They, you know, they go camping in the kind of a group effort, you know. The Burning Man that you mentioned, or Bonnaroo, these are festivals that are very Woodstock-flavored, you know, kind of essence of Woodstock wafts through the air at these events. So I guess we've come around far enough with the turn of the wheel that we can stop looking at only the negative aspects, which I think a lot of sort of indie and Gen X people were, of the counterculture and of Woodstock, and look at that beauty again. It's always going to be both things, right? It's always going to be capitalism and freedom. It's always going to be squalor and beauty. But at different points in history, we focus on a different view. And, you know, now I guess we're maybe longing for that sense of idealism again. And I think, I don't know there will ever be another Woodstock, but there's definitely a nostalgia for it, even among, say, 22-year-olds who were in the womb or maybe were not even anywhere near the womb at that time. So it's interesting how Woodstock is a trick mirror that keeps showing us different reflections, I think.
Anthony, when you think of a 22-year-old today in their musical world, listening back, looking back at this, I mean, you know, put yourself to the extent you can, you know, what would they be drawn to in this music?
Well, you know, I mean, I do teach, I mean, at the University of Pennsylvania,
right, that's
as
right.
a matter of fact. And so, you know, I mean, I'm around people that age a lot, and, you know, I go to shows, and they're there. And I do think that, you know, there really is a surprising amount of interest in what the 60s seem to represent. I mean, that, you know, that meaning shifts. But I think at the moment, what younger musicians and I think younger fans are taking from it is a kind of is that notion of freedom. Yeah, you know, the ability to try whatever you want, the ability to envision something big, even as you're kind of doing it on a small level and communicating with your friends. The ideas are big. You know, there's a, you know, somehow the kind of, you know, there's a kind of communality among a lot of bands. You know, the people play with each other and. All of that stuff has a very 60s feel. And the look, you know, I mean, you go to a place like Williamsburg here in New York, and, you know, I mean, you know, everybody looks like, you know, the band in 1968 or something.
Yeah, there's it's very interesting. Revival here in L.A., it's like total hippie again, so.
Here we go again. Of course, the politics of that time had Vietnam right in the middle. Here's Country Joe and the Fish with the "I Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die" rag. Sing-along crowd. Country Joe and the Fish. Tom's calling from Shelter Island, New York. Tom, what do you hear?
Hi there. I'm actually from Norwich, Vermont, but I'm sitting on my brother's boat at Shelter Island
right now. Lucky you.
It's interesting. In the fall of 69, a friend and I wrote an article for our SDS chapter about how Woodstock represented an unfortunate turn from politics to culture. And listening to the conversation, I think what, for me, in my heart, feels most like Woodstock in the past years is Grant Park election night this past year.
Oh, Barack Obama accepting.
There, but, Yes, and just in terms of what's been most impressive to me is the number of young people, and looking at my own kids and their own concerns about health care and things like that, that, you know, that's the spirit of 40 years ago and what we were trying to do in the first year of the Nixon administration.
So you were hardcore political in the SDS. Does it look to you then that... Was it a wrong turn, the cultural to the fore, or did it ultimately turn out with Barack Obama, or did they even relate to one another?
Well, I saw one interesting comment the other day that in Woodstock probably contributed an awful lot to the cultural reaction, and what you know the past 40 years have not been a very good time politically, if you're a progressive, and that you know Woodstock and what that represented scared an awful lot of people, but I do think that there were some ideals there, and I'm hoping that that spirit is alive and well, and that people will get on the job, and we'll get some health care reforms, and help out the country in some ways, and help out our children and grandchildren.
So pull on that energy maybe one more time. Tom, thank you very much for that. Let's get a call from San Francisco, California, and Diamond Dave. Diamond Dave, you're on the air.
And still here, 71, still a beatnik, hippie, a punk rock anarchist, just back from the Rainbow Gathering where the spirit is still alive. But I want to go back. I don't know exactly because there's a lot to say. But I went back, but I was in the hate from 65, that generation of beatniks who transcended over there.
Haight-Ashbury, right? Yeah.
At the hate, and with the free concerts we had there then, which were kind of the seed ground, and I think had a big influence on people. I heard about people coming together, heard about serving free food, heard about that community and music and sex, drugs, and rock and roll and getting it on. And that spirit is still going on, and it's and I feel so looking back. In fact, there's going to be a big free concert coming up in October here called Woodstock West. Well, in Golden Gate Park, where the first Gathering the Tribes, January 11th, 1967, which was really the model for Woodstock, it was still more manageable. I mean, we had 5,000 or 6,000 people. It seemed like a lot of people, but had no idea, really. Maybe had some suspicion that it would have this enormous explosion, Woodstock, 40 years ago. I'm 71.
Diamond Dave, thank you for the report. Of course... Yeah, it wasn't all born in one weekend at one time. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll coming out of there. And powers, you hear our caller Chris saying, you know, it may actually have reaped the whirlwind in terms of reaction, pushback. Though a lot of the police and so on that were interviewed in the documentary said, hey, this is great, these kids are great. But nationally, it became a kind of symbol of, we're not so sure for conservatives.
Well, yeah. I mean, two things on that point. First of all, Altamont is usually identified the festival that the Rolling Stones headlined that Anthony mentioned, in which an African-American fan was murdered by a security guard. That's kind of often held up as the end of the ideal era, the end of the 60s. But our lovely caller from San Francisco, I lived in San Francisco in the 80s, and what I think is important is that the kind of indie punk rock anarchism that was happening when I was there was directly related to the countercultural stuff that was happening in the 60s and early 70s. So he talks about free food. We had Food Not Bombs, which was an anarchist punk organization that gave food to the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
You think about the colorful costumes of Woodstock, and that directly affected the gay liberation movement, Queer Nation, ACT UP, the kinds of marches I went on in the 80s. I think what we can see now, and what Anthony was talking about his students today, is a willingness to embrace the whole lineage, to see that there doesn't have to be just a break between generations. We can tie and thread the generations together. Yes, there was reaction against Woodstock. Yes, there was reaction against the counterculture, but it always comes back, it always cycles back, and I think now we can see that big picture, and it's a really interesting way to look at the 60s in relation to the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and now, and Obama is our, you know, I mean, in a way, he's our Jimmy, he's our Woodstock, Grant Park was our Woodstock, he's our rock star, he's our pop star, and our president, and that's a very exciting thing.
I came upon a child of God, Joni Mitchell wrote, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young would sing. He was walking along the road, and I asked him, where are you going? And this he told me, and it was all about Woodstock. Inspiring and sad at the same time, Anthony. And Anne says, maybe over these generations, it's getting tied together. There's no great, not such a gulf anymore, maybe.
Well, it would be nice, you know. It seems like there's still a lot of partisan battling going on, and it, you know, it still seems like a fight. You know, I mean, the one thing I think that Woodstock, I mean, that might be worth saying, as someone who was around at that time, is I don't think anybody could have imagined the country moving as far to the right as certainly it did in, you know, the previous 8 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was, I mean, I think really shocking. You know, and you know, there was a reaction. There's no doubt. I think all of those things, you know, in the mind of more conservative viewers, you know, from the Chicago demonstrations at Woodstock, I don't know that they were making distinctions between politics and culture. But there's definitely reasons to hope. And I think, you know, Woodstock and its reminiscences, I think, you know, stir all that.
40 years of reality and reality check. Anthony DeCurtis with Rolling Stones, always great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us on this anniversary, Anthony.
Pleasure.
Wonderful to have you. And Ann Powers in Tuscaloosa, Alabama today with the Los Angeles Times. Ann, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much.
We'll go out with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young from Woodstock. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Check out the website. You can find photos, videos, a lot more about the whole event, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us.
Shotgun!